Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here. Also glad to see faces, many faces. And yeah, Xiyu already indicated that this paper is kind of a mix of my academic path. So it's about convolutions, which I would rather put into the machine learning corner. And it's also about tensor networks, which is more in the physics corner. So this is actually a challenge for this talk, which is why I decided that I would do this in a tutorial style. So I'm pretty sure some of you know tensor networks. I'm pretty sure some of you know convolutions. Maybe not everyone knows both of them. So I'll go from scratch. I'll describe both of them from scratch. I'll then put them together to show you how you can view convolutions as tensor networks. And then hopefully I'll also convince you that we cannot just do this, but we actually get something from doing that. And maybe we can quickly check if the audio is working fine, but I think it should be fine. So for the physicists, consider the first title. For the computer scientists, consider this title, Convolutions as Einsum. Before I talk about this, I want to put this paper into perspective to what I'm doing at Vector. So for that, I give you a very quick, like, 2-minute overview of what I think most of deep learning is. So in deep learning, we try, in supervised deep learning, we try to learn a functional relationship between inputs X and labels Y, and we do that by using a neural network F with trainable parameters theta. So what we do is we feed the input through the network. We then compare the prediction to a label using a loss function, and then we just gather a huge data set and repeat this process for all data in the data set, average the per sample losses, and this gives us what we call the empirical risk, which we then minimize to train the neural network. And the data sets we use in practice are super big, so we can never fit them into our compute pipeline at once, which is why we accept that we only do this on a smaller amount of data, which you call a batch, which is a randomly drawn subset. And then we do this process on just a subset, and we kind of, yeah, accept the fact that this introduces noise into all our computations, which is inherited by everything else in the pipeline too. You can see that the compute graphs here pretty much do the same thing for each example. So what is done in libraries is that they squash this entire sequence of graphs into just a single graph, and they offer batched computations, which means that for all operations, you have like a first axis, which is the batch dimension, and all operations are implemented in this batched mode, which allows you to carry out everything super fast because you can run it on hardware accelerators like GPUs. And the last thing we're missing is the keyword deep. So we don't use just a small network, but we use a deep network. So we have lots of layers. We stack them together, and this gives us a deep neural network. And mathematically speaking, we're just doing function composition, which means that if we want to take derivatives to compute gradients, which we then use to train a neural network, we basically apply the chain rule. And the way this is implemented in ML frameworks is by backpropagation. So we start at the end of the graph, we take an error signal, feed it back through the layers, and each layer itself knows how to take that incoming signal, process it, extract the gradient for its parameters, and pass on the signal to the next layer. Now, I like to think about my work as this two-dimensional landscape, and deep learning land is in the top left corner of this landscape, because almost all applications in deep learning use one quantity, which is also the one which is very easy to compute with software, which is the mini-batch gradient. And my kind of research direction is to figure out what are other interesting properties about the loss that we first need to figure out how to compute efficiently, but then also need to figure out how to use them to build new algorithms. So two directions that are orthogonal to each other are first the kind of statistical direction, which means that the loss and also the gradient are averages over per sample losses or per sample gradients, which means that we actually have a distribution of gradients and then we collapse it into a mean. And instead, we could just consider the entire distribution and compute other properties like the covariance or so, which will tell us how noisy the gradients are. And the second direction is moving from just local linear Taylor approximations to higher order approximations, for example, local quadratics, which will then require us to compute higher order derivatives, such as the Hessian. And of course, we can also go in kind of both directions and end up with statistical information about the Hessian, which will tell us how noisy the curvature information is. And during my PhD, I kind of figured out many tricks how to compute such information. And if I had to sum it up in just one slide, it would be this one probably. And it turns out that if you take the existing gradient backpropagation, you can just add an additional backpropagation. And this way, you can actually compute a lot of other information, like Hessian diagonals, like gradient covariances, et cetera, et cetera. This is basically my PhD thesis. And it boils down to framing the computation as, what do you need to backpropagate? How do you need to backpropagate it? This composes into layers, so each layer needs to know how to do that. And then how to extract information with respect to the parameters. And the takeaway from this is that often you need to write quite some, let's say, non-traditional functionality to get this done. But you're kind of constrained to using the Python API or whatever functionality is offered by your machine learning framework. And this brings me to the point where convolutions come in. So this is my personal struggle with convolutions, but I'm not the only person, which you will see in a second. So for one of the libraries I wrote during my PhD, we had to implement what is called a vector Jacobian product, which is just one example of a slightly non-traditional operation. And the left snippet here shows how to do this for just a linear layer. And you can see that 50% of the code is actually not code, it's just documentation showing what the function does, what shapes it accepts, what shapes it returns, et cetera. The actual code is 3 lines, I think. And the right snippet, which you cannot really read, is the same functionality, but for convolutions. From the color pattern, you can maybe see that there's not so much documentation, so this is actually code, and it's a lot of code. And actually, to get this running with all the features that are offered by convolutions, I think it took us probably 2 years to understand this and implement this. I mean, not working on it all the time, but continuously trying to make progress and understand how to do this. So the point here is that although convolutions are somewhat similar to linear layers, they're actually way more tedious, especially if you want to support all the bells and whistles they offer. And I'm not the only person.
Can I just summarize it in my words? Because I'm not sure if I find.
Yeah.
So you said that convolutions are not compatible with Python API. So what you mean with it is that in the left-hand on the left-hand side, you can basically write down a short form. Mm-hmm. Python does all the heavy lifting, so it's like you can parallelize a lot of operations, and on the right hand side you need to define them separately for each single layer and do a few mathematical operations that are non-standard in Python. Is that the...
So they are kind of non-standard in the sense that you need to figure out what functions you can use. So in the end, you will rely on something from NumPy or PyTorch, some functions which are efficiently implemented, but you need to kind of tweak it a little bit to make it work efficiently. So my whole point is that you see the right snippet. By the end of the talk, I hope we can do this in 3 lines of code with just a single einsum. So this is my personal struggle. There are also other people who struggled with this. There's just a bunch of different algorithmic or also theoretical ideas people have tried to come up with. And the canonical way to do this is you start out with MLPs, which are neural networks that have linear layers. Then you develop your algorithm or your theoretical concept in that framework. And then 1, 2, 3, sometimes 30 years later, somebody does the same thing for convolutions because they are more challenging. So the goal of this talk is to kind of introduce you how we can frame convolutions as tensor networks. And then hopefully you will understand that by viewing them as tensor networks, the implementation becomes very simple to understand and sometimes also very efficient. So before doing that, I want to give you a quick walkthrough of how convolutions work, because it's just fun to watch animations. And I also want to kind of walk you through the ABC, because there's a lot of stuff that's offered by convolutions. So let's start with the most basic one. We have an input, x, and we have a smaller kernel, w. And what we do during convolution is we slide that kernel over the input, and at each step, we take the dot product between the kernel and the patch it currently overlaps with. And this then forms the output element. Now, there are different hyperparameters which allow to control how you slide the kernel over the input. For example, if you want to do more aggressive downsizing of the input, you can just use what is called a larger stride. So you can just move the kernel faster over the input, which will give you a smaller signal. Then you can add padding. In this case, for example, I chose the padding so that the input size is preserved, which is something you may want to do if you, for example, use ResNets. And then you have dilation, which is placing some blank pixels or kind of adding spacing between the kernel elements before you slide them. And so far, this was all on just one channel. So of course, we can do the same thing for multiple channels. There's a question.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit confused what padding does.
Padding basically adds zeros out at the edges, yeah. So there's two motivations. One is to preserve a certain size of the input. Mm-hmm. The second motivation is that you kind of want to avoid artifacts from the edge.
I see. And then the x times w is a linear function.
It's a linear function. So far, everything is one channel. Now we can go to multiple channels and do the same operation with multiple input channels, which means that now the kernel is also a collection of vectors which do the dot product in parallel. And then we can not only produce one output channel, but if we have multiple such kernel, let's call them banks, we can also have multiple, repeat the same process, and create multi-channel outputs. And then we can not only do that, but we can also kind of split the channels into groups and do convolutions on those groups individually, which is called group convolution. And you kind of see where I'm going with this. So I keep adding more and more features to it. This is not the last one. We have one more. There's batch size, which means that usually we don't do things on just a single signal, but we have a batch of data coming in. We want to do everything in parallel. And then, of course, we want to do everything together. So we want to do a batched group convolution, multiple input channels, multiple output channels with stride, padding, dilation. And then we don't want to do this in 1D, but we want to do this in 2D. So hopefully now you see why this is actually way more tedious than just a linear layer, which is just a matrix vector product. And the man whose silhouette you can see here in this 2D picture. I mean, it's a bit crude, but it's supposed to be Einstein. This guy's summation convention will help us to figure out how we can simplify convolutions through tensor networks. So I'm going to give you a quick intro to tensor networks, tensor multiplication. I'm pretty sure most of you are familiar with it, but I noticed that one challenge with this work is kind of to find the right audience that knows about all the different things. So I decided I will just talk about all the basics before we put them together. For me, one disclaimer. Tensor for me is just a multidimensional array. So I'm not going to distinguish between co and contravariant indices, although maybe doing so would be a good idea, but probably a separate talk. So for me, tensor multiplication is a unification of the operations we do with matrices and vectors. So if we just consider two vectors, there are different ways to multiply them. We can take the inner product, we can take their element-wise product, or we can take the outer product. And you all know how these operations are defined in terms of indices. And then we can also do the same thing for matrices. But here we can already discover that the kind of framework breaks down a little bit. So inner multiplication is now matrix multiplication. Element-wise multiplication is still the same. And for the Kronecker product, we can already see that now we have four indices, but we actually want to stay in matrix land, so we need to kind of find a way to group them together and end up with a matrix again, which is what I've indicated here with the parentheses. And of course, there are many more ways to multiply two matrices together. Like you can flatten them both and take the dot product of them. This is not contained in this table here, but the way tensor multiplication unifies all of those operations is by looking at the index signatures of them. So if you just look at the indices, let's take, for example, the inner matrix-matrix multiplication. We can actually infer what's happening just by looking at the indices. So I has indices ij, B has indices jk, and the output has indices ik, which means the j must have disappeared somewhere in between, which means we summed it out. So this is the whole point of tensor multiplication. If we want to unify or like mathematically formalize this a little bit by moving on from vectors, matrices to tensors, we'll consider two tensors who have index tuples SA and SB. And then we can define a tensor multiplication described by SA, SB, and SC as taking A and B, indexing them with the two index tuples, and then summing out all the indices that are not present in the output. It becomes a bit tedious because we have to use set notation to do this, but you get the high level idea, and also it becomes very clear in the matrix-matrix multiplication example where we have ij, jk, ik for the three tuples, and then to figure out which index we need to sum over, we just unite the indices of the inputs and subtract the indices of the output, which will give us j as expected. And this, it looks a bit rough the first time you see it, but we're actually using this in code quite a bit. So the operation I've defined here is actually what einsum does, if you've ever used the einsum function. So this is a mathematical definition of what einsum does. And the only thing we do translating from the math to the code is that we string encode the index signature, so to say, by like putting a comma between the input indices and having this arrow, which then maps to the output indices. And of course, einsum does not only work on two tensors. You can pass an arbitrary number of tensors. So the generalization of this binary tensor multiplication would be we take a sequence of n tensors and we get their index tuples and we have the output index tuple. We do the same thing, unite all the indices in the input tuples, subtract the output, then we know which ones we need to sum out. Okay, that's einsum. You can see that the notation is a bit, complex, but this is actually useful to, for example, prove some properties of the operation. And a way more intuitive way to think about this is with tensor networks, which are basically a graphical way to reason about these einsums. And the components of this language are those boxes. Boxes can have legs, and the number of legs indicates what type of tensor it is. So a vector is a rank one tensor, so it has one leg. A matrix is a rank two tensor, so it has two legs, etc. And many works also use the directions of the legs to indicate what type of index it is. I'm not going to do that here, because for deep learning or machine learning, we know by the name of an index which position it has. So I'm just using the directions here randomly. Now, if we are given a single box, we can also reshape it. So we can kind of take multiple indices, unite them into a single index, or we can take one index and kind of ungroup it into multiple indices. And I'm going to use the triangle symbol here to indicate that we're reshaping some indices. And the last ingredient we need is how to indicate summations, which is just by connecting legs. So if we want to take the trace of a matrix, we connect the row index and the column index with a closed line, which means sum over the elements. And with that, we can write down all the matrix operations we've seen previously. So matrix-matrix multiplication is just draw the two matrices, connect the column and row of A and B. Element-wise is just take the two tensors, connect the row indices and the column indices, but don't sum them. So we need to have the legs stick out to indicate that we don't want to sum them. And the Kronecker product is just placing the two, just placing them there, and then have those little triangles to kind of bring them back to a matrix by combining the two row and the two column indices into a single bigger row and column index. Yeah, so that's pretty much the kind of operations or the kind of language we need for the rest of the talk. There are two more which are interesting for machine learning, which is that we can not only do tensor multiplications, but we can also extract subtensors. So for example, if we have a matrix and we only want to take its diagonal, we can do that with tensor networks too. Or we can take a vector and embed it in the diagonal of a matrix. And we can also do that in blocks, for example, which is very interesting for higher order information, which I may just hint at later in the talk. So, okay, what's the point of doing this? What's the point of having this abstraction in terms of an einsum function or in terms of this diagram that we can draw? I think there are many reasons, and I actually started to use einsum all over in my code. I think I'm not using dot inner matmul bmm trace, whatever. I just completely stopped using them. I write everything in einsum. And the one reason I do that is that it allows me to write very readable code. Because there are packages like this inops package, which allows you to give multi-letter names to an index. So for example, if I have a matrix-matrix multiplication and I want to vmap it, so I want to basically add a batch dimension, I can just do that by literally adding a batch dimension to the string. And everyone can immediately read off what the dimension of the tensors are. And another example, this is actually from an iClear submission from end of September. So this is a state-of-the-art machine learning code. It's one of my submissions. The code was originally copied over from some repository with 100 plus stars. So this is code that is used by a lot of other people. But when I saw this first, I had no idea what was going on. So we have this X, and then we unfold it twice. And then we transpose the first and the second, and then the second and the third axis. And just following through that is really challenging because initially you have no idea what shape X has. Maybe you can infer it from the context. Maybe somebody put a comment in there to help you figure this out. But even if you figure this out, now you reshape it, there's lots of magic numbers, then you sum over the third axis, and then you reshape it again into something that you don't know what size it will be. Okay, one way to fix this is add comments everywhere, indicating what's happening, what the shapes are, etc. Another way is to just use inops. And turns out we can do this, and we can kind of take the comments that would help fix the other code and kind of bake them directly into the code, which will make it very readable, and you don't need to maintain the comments extra. So here the second line is just, we can see that X has a batch dimension, and the second dimension is kind of combined group and in channels, and all we do is just separate the two of them. Then in the line three, we average out the group index. Then we do some unfolding, and the last line is we can now actually see what unfolding does to the tensor. So we have a batch axis, then we have a combination of in channels and kernel sizes, and then a third one with output sizes together, and then we basically just swap the last two dimensions, which is the double transpose that we saw in the earlier code, which was, I think, way more complicated to infer. So we can not only write more readable code, we can also write code with better performance out of the box. And to see that, we're going to again take a very simple example, A times B times V, where A and B are matrices, V is a vector. And we just want to multiply them together. Like the way I think about it, or also the way the tensor network community thinks about this, is you have those three tensors and you want to contract them into a single tensor. And for this simple example, there are two ways of doing that. So first, we can just multiply A with B, then multiply it onto V. This is actually, I would say from a coding perspective, this would be the preferred way of writing it. because we don't need to do anything. We just write A times B times V, what we want to do. The second way would be take B, multiply it onto V, then take A, multiply it onto B times V. And this requires putting a parenthesis in your code, and this will give you a speed up of 500, because it's much cheaper to multiply a matrix onto a vector twice instead of multiplying two matrices and then onto a vector. But for that, we have to start cluttering up our code. We need to put parentheses, and these parentheses will also depend on the matrices. So sometimes we don't know the dimension of those. Maybe they depend on the batch size, which a user will pick. So the parenthesization will depend on what the user specified. Any guess what will happen if we put this into Einsam? Will it be more like schedule 1 or more like schedule 2? Any guess?
One?
Interesting. You're correct. And it was kind of surprising to me. Why is this happening? Why is it not efficient? But it turned out I was using a very old version of PyTorch. And after upgrading, it was installing a package called opt-einsam. And this package by default is enabled now in Torch. So by default, if you install like the latest PyTorch from 1 year ago, not a super old version like I was doing, you actually get the almost optimal performance. You have a slight epsilon on top because Einsam actually needs to go and first look at what path is better. And there are very good heuristics for doing this, also for bigger tensor networks. So the takeaway here is you can just feed it into Einsam. It will automatically take care of how to do the contractions. So far, we talked about code. The last thing I want to talk about before we actually do the merge of convolution and tensor networks is doing function transformations in the tensor network language. So for example, we often want to batch something. If you know JAX, for example, VMAP is like very fashionable these days. So for our matrix-matrix vector product, all we need to do to batch this is literally just add a batch dimension to all the different tensors and then connect them and have the legs stick out because we don't want to sum over the batch dimension. So that's literally it. Batching is very easy. The second interesting function transformation is taking derivatives. So we can consider the derivative of ABV with respect to, say, B, which is the Jacobian with respect to B. And we would probably do this the first time on paper by translating it back to the tensor multiplication equation, which has the sum and product of Aij, Bjk, and Vk. But from that perspective, you can then see if you take the derivative with respect to J prime, K prime, B, it basically will give you a delta, a Kronecker delta, JJ prime, KK prime. You can sum that out, and it will basically just rename the indices and remove the tensor from the network. So taking derivatives is nothing but removing a tensor from a tensor network. And if you want to take the derivative with respect to A, you have the additional challenge that A has a leg sticking out to the left, so we don't really know what to do with that. We can fix this by just adding an identity to the left. Then we have the same situation as before. We can just remove A, and we get the Jacobian as identity Kronecker BV. And I think this is also a very nice way of kind of appreciating how you get Kronecker structure in your Jacobians. If you have a chain, you remove one of the operands, you're going to get two diagrams which are separate, which means that the Jacobian has kind of a factorization, a Kronecker product structure in that sense. So summing up, why would it be cool to have convolution as Einsam? Would be because, well, in general, this is a general recommendation beyond convolutions. Use Einsam wherever you can. You get better readability, and you get automatically good code performance. What I am not discussing in this talk is that if you want to do a really big contraction, there are also packages which allow you to automatically distribute the contraction onto, say, multiple GPUs. And what I didn't find a good package for, but what I think would be really cool to have, is also one for approximately contracting a tensor network. So in machine learning, we do this a lot. We have the loss. It's a sum over a lot of data points. And we just embrace the noise and just draw a mini batch, just draw some summons and then evaluate those. We can do exactly the same for a tensor network. It's just a bunch of summons. So we can impose a probability distribution over the summons, then just sample a bunch of them, evaluate those, rather than contracting everything. This will give us a speed up in exchange for noise. So this would also be cool to have in the future. And yeah, I also have some ideas what to do with that. And if you're not writing code, I also encourage you to use tensor networks. It's really fun to do a derivation by drawing those diagrams, manipulating them. And I end up doing this a lot, although I work in machine learning. So it's a very refreshing, intuitive perspective to reason about those tensor multiplications without having to go through index fights, basically. OK, with that, you now know convolutions. You know tensor networks. Let's put them together. Before we do that, I want to, again, start building up the perspective. So far, I've shown you those animations where we have tensors. And now people have thought about how to express this in terms of matrix multiplication. So one way we can turn convolution into matrix multiplication is that we take the patches, we stack them into the columns of a matrix, which is called the so-called unfolded input. That's the X with the double brackets. And then you can write convolution as a matrix multiplication of the matrix, a matrix-sized kernel, and the unfolded input. The only thing you need to do after the matrix multiplication is reshape everything back into a tensor. This is just a very simple illustration, but it works also if you add all the other features, like in channels, out channels, etc. So this view leaves the kernel the same and touches the input. We can also do the other thing. We can take the input, flatten it, and then think about this input being processed by a matrix A, which will then yield the flattened output Y. And to do that, we would have to take the kernel and copy it into the right locations of the matrix A. This matrix will be sparse, and it will be very structured. So here you can see it has this banded structure. And if you turn on some other hyperparameters, it will get a bit messier, but still very sparse and very structured. And a good way to imagine convolution is implicit multiplication with this matrix, because we never want to build it up in memory because it's very big, very sparse. And this perspective is very useful because this is basically a linear layer, right? So if we somehow had a good way to connect A with W, then it would be way easier to transfer algorithmic ideas from linear layers to convolutions. We could even think about converting a linear layer to a convolution or a convolution to a linear layer. And another thing that's very interesting is that this view allows you to define what transpose convolution means. Because convolution is multiplication with A, and transpose convolution is multiplication with the transpose of A. So it would take a vector from the Y space, map it to a vector in X space. And it is actually really hard to find a good, concise definition of transpose convolution. So I'm not even showing this here in the talk. So we saw there's linear layers transferred to convolutions. There's another transfer to transpose convolutions, which is even more challenging because transpose convolutions are really hard to write down. OK, but now let's do the actual thing. We've spent 34 minutes to lay out all the fundamentals. Let's finally do the thing and write down convolution as a tensor network. So we start from the index notation. For an output element, we need to take the kernel, we need to take all the k elements, and we need to contract them with the input locations that are active in the input. And the problem is that those active input locations depend on which kernel element we're looking at and which output element we're currently computing. And a way to resolve this is by introducing a new tensor, pi, which I call the index pattern, which captures which input elements connect or overlap with which kernel elements to produce a certain output element. So in pictures, let's look at the first element of this kernel W. And as the kernel slides over the input, all we do is place a 1 in the position that kind of fixes the input to output location. And then we have to do this for all elements in the kernel, and then we get pi. Pi is very easy to compute. You can, like, if you want to do it with all the hyperparameters, it will take you like an afternoon to write it down, but you can compute it very efficiently. It is sparse, which for now we will not use, but maybe I can comment on that at the end of the talk. It is binary, so we can store it in Boolean form. And it is usually not very big. So computing it and storing it additionally is fine from a computational perspective. And now we can write down the tensor network for convolution. So X connects with the in-channel to the weight, and the index pattern connects input location with kernel location and forms the output location. So that's convolution as tensor network. This is 1D convolution. Now, let's try to, so the rest of the talk will be basically applying what we just learned about tensor networks to this specific tensor network. So this is 1D convolution. For 2D convolution, we can imagine that the way the kernel slides over the different dimensions, the two directions are independent. So if we have another spatial dimension, all we do is just add another index pattern and add the contractions that are needed with input and kernel location. And you can see where this is going. So if we want 3 spatial dimensions, just add another index pattern. If we want 4, add another index pattern, et cetera. So this is how you get higher dimensional convolutions. Next thing is we're going to connect the tensor network to the matrix multiplication. So the unfolded input and the unfolded kernel. And I told you that the unfolded kernel matrix multiplied onto W yields the result of the convolution. So we basically take this tensor network and we split the W part from the other part. And then we matricize this because it currently has like 4 legs. Oh no, it has more than 2 legs. So we need to reshape it into a matrix again. This will give us the unfolded input. Same for the unfolded kernel. So we can separate X from the rest of the tensor network. This will give us the unfolded kernel as a matrix. And now we can also write down transpose convolution, which is something that I think I really appreciate this network, because this is, I think to the best of my knowledge, this is the simplest definition of transpose convolution that I know. And I also like that it's very close to the actual convolution. So it just says, rather than contracting over the input locations, we contract over the output location. So we map from output location to input location rather than from input to output location. But we use the same spatial pattern, so the same connectivity pattern as from the original convolution. Okay, next. So we know how to take derivatives. Let's take derivatives. So we do that by just removing the tensor we want to differentiate with. For example, for the kernel, this will yield this form of Jacobian. For the input, we just remove X. We get the Jacobian with respect to the input. And the way these two matrices are used, so I would argue that the Jacobians are interesting from a theoretical perspective, but the way these Jacobians are used in practice is by vector Jacobian products in AutoDiff. And these are usually just black boxes. It's some CUDA kernel, and you don't really have access to that. The right top tensor network is taking the Jacobian and contracting it with a vector. So this is the weight vector Jacobian product, which would be used in AutoDiff. And the same thing for the input Jacobian. And now you can go back and see some more interesting connections. So for example, you can see that the input BJP is actually transpose convolution. You can also see that the weight BJP can sometimes be mapped to a special other convolution. So seeing all those connections is very interesting, but I don't have enough time to comment on all of them here. So rather, I want to emphasize that usually these are black boxes. Now with these tensor networks, we can just use them, implement them, play around, try new ideas with them without having to modify some CUDA code. And of course, this is first order derivatives. We're not done here. Like for me, second order derivatives are very interesting. So of course, we can do this for second order derivatives and their approximations too. And I'm not going to talk about them here because this is probably a completely different talk, how to kind of introduce them. But I just want you to see that they basically have two Jacobians rather than one. And we do some contractions. And then we, on top of that, can, for example, decide to only compute the diagonal or only compute a mini block diagonal because those matrices are really big. So we often are just interested in computing diagonals or smaller subtensors of them. And there's even more. So far, we only had autodiff, so Jacobian style things. There are also other algorithmic ideas people came up with, like Kronecker factorized curvature approximations. Basically, all these works I've listed in the initial table, you can write them as einsums. And there are many more if you want to check out the table in the paper's appendix. OK. One last example, then I'll wrap it up. So far, I've shown you that you can phrase a lot of operations of convolutions as tensor networks. They are easy to modify. They're easy to evaluate. We can use all the existing machinery for efficient contraction. So can we improve something in practice? And the last 5 minutes I'm going to spend on just giving you a very concrete example. There are more thorough examples in the actual paper, but I want to focus on this specific one because I think it's a very good representation of fixing something that's currently hard to do. It's about KFAC. So KFAC is, I'm not sure if any one of you knows, it's a second order optimizer, and it is based on a Kronecker factorization of the curvature matrix, which means we're computing two matrices and then use first matrix, Kronecker, second matrix as an approximation to the Hessian. And KFAC is, I would say, the state-of-the-art second order method for deep learning. It's used in quite some interesting problems where first order methods don't work. And this one here is actually going to be presented at NeurIPS next week. So it's kind of the latest KFAC that people might want to try out. And the way people compute this matrix for KFAC is as follows. So we take X, which is the input to the convolution. We unfold it, average over patches. This gives us a vector, and we take the outer product of that vector. So don't worry about the math. Unfold the input, average over patches, take the outer product. We can write this as a tensor network. It's very easy. And it actually turns out that the implementation on the left is highly suboptimal because we need to compute the unfolded input, which is really big. It's a really big matrix. Instead, we can do the patch averaging just by averaging the connectivity patterns before and then contracting them into the input. And if we do this, we'll get a speed up of 3 to 4x, sometimes even more than that. And now you might say, OK, like now you made this one specific operation inside of a second order method faster. OK, you still have all the other things going on, like forward pass, backward pass, gradient computation, et cetera. What is also really cool is that, so imagine you have X and you have the result of this operation, the KFAC matrix. The left implementation needs to allocate additional memory. And for this case, for some convolution of a neural network, in this case, it needs to allocate 3 gigs of RAM on top to storing X and the result tensor. The tensor network implementation doesn't have to do that. It just uses 0 extra memory, which means if you're running on a GPU with I don't know, maybe 12 to 32 gigs of RAM. Saving 3 gigs in peak memory will allow you to go to significantly larger batch sizes and run this algorithm for larger batch sizes. And kind of, it's kind of known, or there are some insights in that second order methods work better in this regime. So using this implementation, we can just stretch the regime in which we can run such a second order method. And this is just batch size 32. So if you double the batch size, I believe the number in the bottom left will also double. So you'll have 6 gigs of extra memory, which is just allocated and then freed later on. So we can also get really good speed up on some non-traditional operations on top of the better understanding and the better connection to linear layers. And this is really what I want you to take home. So by this view of convolution as a tensor network, we get a really nice perspective that allows us to connect it to linear layers, allows us to easily transfer ideas from this regime to the convolution, even for transpose convolution. And often the implementation is not only faster, but what I think is really good is that it's flexible. So you have access to it. It's not a CUDA kernel which only has some binary code and no public code lying around that you can tweak with. So if you have an idea what to do with convolutions, I think this framework is really nice because it gives you access to everything. You can play around. You can just try out your ideas and just feed it to Einsam, because it will take care of how to efficiently contract everything. So I am also releasing a library with this paper. And the rough usage is really like this. So you just decide what you want to compute, let's say the KFAC reduce from the previous slide. Then all you do is you create an Einsam expression, which is basically the operands and the equation, and then you just feed it to Einsam. Or you can do something in between, depending on what you want. And you can, for example, apply this to the weight Jacobian we've seen in the beginning of the talk. So we can basically take this huge snippet and just compress it into 3 lines, maybe 4 lines of code. So yeah, I encourage you to check out the paper if you have any cool ideas how to play around with convolutions. Or maybe what I don't really know much about is how you would maybe take this building block and use it inside of an actual tensor network method, maybe more in the physics regime. I'd be really interested in chatting and figuring out if this is useful also for real tensor network applications and not only for my own work. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions, and thanks for listening.
So thank you for the very nice talk. It's very nice work. We have many people online. Okay, so Benjamin, would you like to ask your question? Oh, sorry, you're clapping. I'm so sorry. Okay. So we have many people online. Does anybody have any questions?
Can I ask first a very general question?
Yes.
That's always on my mind, but no one could tell me an answer. Maybe you can. So you've been working on higher order methods to calculate gradients to optimize neural networks better. So what I'm always wondering is, we do not necessarily want to find the lowest lying minimal parameters that minimize the loss function, but we want to find some kind of a region in the loss function that generalizes well, which is not the same. So what I'm wondering is, when you perform this kind of research, you do not necessarily. How do you merge this in your head that you want a better optimizer, but you do not want to find the minimum?
Yeah, you need to break this down into different stages, I would argue. So I agree that when we say we want to minimize the loss, we actually don't want to minimize the loss. We want to minimize it such that the minimum we find generalizes well. So one way to frame this, I would say, is kind of offload the responsibility to a regularizer. So let's say we have a loss and we know properties of minima we want to reach. So we can just add a regularization term on top of the loss. And then we've kind of reduced the problem to just minimizing an objective as quickly as possible. So this is one way I kind of justify that we actually want to do mathematical optimization. Although you could argue that we don't really understand how to regularize such that we end up in a local minimum that generalizes well.
So if I understand correctly, this is that the idea is that you represent convolutional neural network, specifically the pooling part, into tensor network, and then you can utilize the optimal ensemble to make the performance better.
Mm-hmm. This is the rough idea. So I should maybe also talk a little bit about limitations, because you've, for example, seen that this pi tensor I showed you earlier, it's very sparse, which means that if you just feed it into einsum naively, it will do all the multiplications with the zeros. So because right now, there's no way to do an einsum between dense tensors and sparse tensors. There's just no support for doing this, although this might be very interesting, maybe. So I would say, if you want to use this as a drop-in replacement for convolution, don't do it. There is highly optimized CUDA code. People have figured out how to do convolutions efficiently for a very long time. If you want to do something slightly non-traditional, the tensor network perspective will probably be much better than having to reuse some existing Python API.
And non-traditional, you mean?
For example, you want to compute the k-fig matrix. For example, you want to compute the Fisher's diagonal, or you want to compute a randomized form of the vector Jacobian product. Yeah.
I had a quick question.
Yeah.
So from what I saw before, right, you have the X and the W, which essentially bring in the information on the values that you have on your input and your kernel, right? But everything else, like the dilation and everything that you comment on, essentially comes from the pi.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And could you maybe say a bit more about like how difficult it is to calculate the pi and how much stuff you only have to calculate maybe once at the beginning and then?
So it is basically a Kronecker delta. And you can write this down in terms of linear algebra expressions like Lin spaces, etc. So it is very efficient. I can actually, after the talk, I can just show you the implementation. It's like five lines of code or so. But yeah, you're right. So this pi tensor is kind of nice in that it kind of shields all the hyperparameters. So it kind of just fixes all of that. Nobody has to ever touch those again.
Any more questions?
Okay, I had a question about if you were to try and do einsum for maybe thousands of matrices, like chain multiplied, you can't do this like in, you can only have a certain number of matrices usually to multiply with einsum. Do you have any suggestions on how to kind of batch, something like that?
Yeah, this is very, this is actually a good question, and I think I don't have a good answer for it, because in my use cases, I usually have tensor networks with, say, up to maybe six tensors. So I'm not sure if I have a good answer to your question.
No problem. Thanks.
Okay, one quick question. Can you do like shift and trace it, like do an index shift in the einsum?
What do you mean by index shift?
I plus one.
I'm not sure. I think in the current einsum, no. But these are very interesting questions for like what are the directions we need to like improve it even further. Yeah, so I think what you're basically asking is not to extract a diagonal of the matrix, but something like the off diagonal. So you would index at I plus one. Okay. Yeah, something like that. I don't think this exists at the moment. Yeah.
There's no more questions. Let's thank Alex for this very nice talk.